Welcome to TA1, everything you wanted to know about adventure racing and then some. I'm your host, legendary Randy Erickson, and guess who's with me? Yeah, Jimmy. See if she'll stay quiet. So, one last hurrah before the new year with Strong Machine, talking still world championships, and yeah, so we're going to hear more about that. What else is going on? Had a good Christmas. Had a good week before Christmas in Florida. And, yeah, starting to look forward to next year. C2C is not that far away. And a bunch of other things, not specifically adventure race oriented, probably happening next year. So pretty excited about that. And, yeah. Ready to get going, although it's really cold today. Ready to get that part over with. And then I'm looking at forecast next week. Tuesday, 55. Wednesday, 16. Highs both days. So that'll be interesting. Anyway, let's get this show on the road. And remember, slow is fast. Fast is good. Be safe. Have a good new year, and thanks for listening. Well, hey, talk to you next year. Bye.
Are you talking about our last USA Array call when it very suddenly ended?
No, I was just talking about... Randy mentioned how it's hard to, like, know when and how to end video calls. And I was
Yeah,
how at work in 2020, after a few months of meetings lasting way too long with like the 15-minute never-ending closure, we just said like, all right, you know, Kate, you've got the power tonight. When the time comes, just hit the button and we're done. No saying nice. Goodbye. We'll probably talk to each other again in 2 hours anyway, so.
Nice. Hey, so, Randy.
The secret on your phone when you want to get off a call is you switch it to airplane mode. So, how are you guys? I see. Look who I got with me, right there.
Hey, Chili. Chili's mine's over there.
Yeah.
This one knows when I get on a call, and he comes and he stares at me like that. Sorry, buddy. You've got all the things. You can go lay down. I'll be there in a bit.
Must be the voices, maybe.
Yeah, he thinks there's new people to talk to.
Yeah. So how you guys been recovered?
Yes, I was actually talking to somebody tonight that I've gone through whatever the Adventure Racers version is of the expedition recovery that aligns with like the 12 stages of grief. You start with retirement and thinking this is the dumbest sport ever, and then you think I'll race again, but I'm only doing short ones. And then you think, maybe someday I'll do an expedition. Then you're like, no, I want to do one next year. Then you get excited about doing one. Then you think about maybe doing two. And then you look at the calendar to figure out how many you can fit in the year. And you're like, how did I get back here? So that's kind of where I'm at.
I think I'm following exactly the same path here. So, yeah, mentally and physically feeling much better than, after the race ended.
So are you fighting? I mean, okay. You guys probably don't get to race as much as you want, but are you seeing that you have to make a lot of choices in races?
Yeah,
I think you can make choices.
Yeah, I mean it's exciting. There's been a lot of expedition races coming on the calendar, especially for this next year, and such a really cool split between U.S. races. And obviously the international scene, but the U.S. scene especially is picking up. So I think, yeah, more than in years past, it's been a real, especially, you know, so for my husband, Cliff and I, since we both race and we have a four-year-old, it's like triaging childcare and things. So, you know, we've always had to have kind of conversations about which race we're going to do, but it seems like we've got so many more options this year. It's exciting.
Yeah, I actually got to race a lot in 2020. Part of me would argue a little bit too much early on. So it's my job now is the way I justify it. So yeah, there is actually, I mean, especially after 2020, I guess it was 2021, I got to race a lot. But after 2020, yeah, there are, it feels like a lot more options, and there actually are a lot more options. So looking at the calendar, then if you're going to do any expedition racing, you know, that's not just the 2 weeks to go to the race. You don't want to be going, doing a 24-hour the weekend before you leave. I didn't want to do much of anything for 3 weeks after getting back. So it's like you got to block big chunks of time out and then figure how that big race fits in around the other races you want to do. So.
Oh, do you guys have anything specific picked out that you're like, this is probably the one, and you're working your schedule from that way?
What about you, Kate?
We've got, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, so Team Strong Machine. So that's my kind of home team here. And we've got a good crew of racers and lots of enthusiasm for, you know, wanting to go out and race for lots of races. Me personally, I've got Endless Mountains in Pennsylvania. That's kind of my expedition race on the calendar for next year. And then all the other kind of East Coast races that I can make it to, and national, some of these kind of anchor points. But I admit that today I started thinking like, huh, I could probably squeeze another expedition race in next year. So I'm trying to see if possible when that might be.
Yeah.
I'm kind of in the same boat. I was looking at Endless Mountains. That's in June, right? So it's like, okay, that's kind of middle of the season, kind of get that team sorted out, figure out how we're going to tackle that one, and then start working out from there. And like I said, in those phases of expedition delirium recovery, I was like, I got to pick between Expedition Oregon and Endless Mountains. And now I'm like, maybe I can do both, you know, and maybe they're far enough apart. And then somebody reached out to me today about doing a race in April too. So I don't think I can do April, May, June. So I'm going to have to make a decision here in the next month or so.
Yep. What do you think, Kate? How you want to put some money on whether he does all three?
You know, Garrison has a way of showing up at a lot of races. So.
I feel like I'm. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I feel like if I say I'm not going to do too much, I'm going to start sounding like Latanzi, who always says he's not going to, then he does.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So how exciting is it to have an expedition race in driving distance, basically, for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. It's like, you know, we shove all our gear in boxes and bags to get it across the ocean. And here it's like, I can throw it on my bike on my bike rack, and, you know, fill my car with everything I could possibly imagine. So we did that for, so I live in Maine. So Untamed the last time was a really easy trip for us, but Pennsylvania will be super easy.
Yeah, this technically will be my first one that I would actually call driving distance, because I've driven to Untamed twice. The first year was in Maine in 2012. The second year was, I guess, Vermont, or I forget which state we started and ended in. But in 2018, that was like a 24-hour drive from Indiana. So yeah, I drove there, but I wouldn't exactly call it driving distance.
It sucked. It's one of those races that's like, yeah, I can drive, I can fly, right? You just make that decision. And whichever one you pick is going to be, you're going to think the other way would have been better. So, so you didn't get to drive to Worlds. See what a segue I made there?
Yeah, that was good.
Smooth.
So, Kate, it was probably actually quicker to fly there than it will be to drive to Pennsylvania for you.
Yeah, probably. Yep.
Yeah. So, who else was on the team? Or you two? Who else?
You're the captain. You answer these questions.
Yeah, I'll captain us through this. So it was. So we're racing as Team Strong Machine. So it was myself, and I'm one of the kind of co-owners of Strong Machine Adventure Racing, based in Portland, Maine. So it was me and Garrison, and it took us, we didn't really realize until at least midway through the season that we were even going to be doing this race. my husband Cliff had taken a spot on the ARWC roster there for our team. And then it became pretty clear that we weren't going to get our kind of usual teammates to sign up and register for it. So, so I kind of was chatting with Garrison. We had wanted to maybe do ITERA, which ended up not happening. And I think you had had a team ready for that to go. And then we kind of found ourselves back at square one. So the two of us reached out to Mark Latanzi, who joined us maybe like midsummer, and then Jason Erkfitz soon afterwards. So that was our group of four. And even right up to the last minute, Garrison kept it a little interesting with an injury that he was trying to recover from. So actually, even the week before the race, we were scrambling to see if possibly we might change the roster again. But that's what it ended up with, was me, Mike, and Mark, and Jason. So it was a good group for us.
So what is it about this race in American Team that it was more of a hassle to get there than the actual race, it sounds like, between Bend and Quest and you guys? And
we actually, I was the only one that created the entertainment about getting there. You know, it was, my knee was bothering me, and I kept looking at that first stage of 75 miles on foot, and I'm freaking out thinking I'm going to get reduced to being dragged through that and then the rest of the race. But like logistically getting there, I think we had some of the easier times of anybody, because lots of people had missing gear and delayed flights and all kinds of, like, the worst case scenario. We always talk about that, like, you're super stressed about flying with all this junk, especially to another country, and getting there with it. And then lots of times when you go home, you're like, I'm just going to throw it in one of my boxes and bags, and I don't care if it gets home a week after me. I'll figure it out, you know, on the other side. There's no stress there. But yeah, us getting there, it was relatively smooth, thankfully.
Yeah. So how soon did you guys go? A few days early or a week or?
Oh, I'm remembering. I think we got there, you know, Jason got there a day earlier with his wife Kelly than the rest of us did, but I believe the rest of us got in on Wednesday and the race started Saturday. So that was actually, I thought, plenty of time. We had plenty of time to kind of, acclimate to the time zone and go to, you know, the stores, get our food and organize gear and all of that. Yeah, a bunch of times. That seemed like a pretty good amount of time for, especially just a fairly quick trip. I flew from Boston, which is a really easy trip to Spain.
Yeah. So maybe this race didn't do it so much, but do you guys, either one of you, ever have problems with jet lag flying? Because I'm going to say I never really have, but you hear all these horror stories, but. So you guys been okay or had problems?
I would feel, in my previous work life, I would go to Denmark a couple times a year. And if I had to stick to like a traditional work schedule when I got there, so get up at like 6, get in the office at 7:30 or 8 or whatever, then I would feel it because you're all out of whack, you know. But other than the scheduled stuff to prep for the race, you know, as long as I'm able to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep, I haven't really felt like a huge impact of jet lag. It's just, as long as I can keep the anxiety managed well enough to actually sleep through the night for the few nights before the race, then it usually doesn't bug me too much.
How about you, Kate?
I think same. Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest time difference that I traveled for a race was, well, Garrison and I both went to Fiji. And that was, I mean, I don't even remember how many hours it was. It was a lot of hours to travel and then to acclimate to. And it's hard to tell what was just the almost like literal jet lag of being like, I was on this airplane for so many hours and, you know, the toll that takes on your body and things. For me, usually once I can get a good night's sleep, like overnight, then I'm fairly well adjusted, even if it's a big difference. And then it's funny because I suppose once you're racing, you don't exactly operate on a full like day and night schedule necessarily anyway, so maybe it's not the worst thing, I suppose.
Yeah, I think you guys' sleep schedules, well, you're probably relatively used to having screwed up sleep schedules. So maybe that being athletes and being fit probably makes a huge difference.
Yeah, but, you know, Kate already knows this as we were talking after the race about recovery. This race by far broke my sleep schedule worse than any other race I've done. Prior to this race, you know, Eco Challenge, like she said, we did together, which is, I forget, like 7 or 8 days. But we were sleeping pretty aggressive. I say sleeping aggressively. That sounds very strange. We were sleeping a lot in that race because there was a long window to complete the full course. In this race in Spain, we did not sleep a whole bunch. And I was out of whack for a good week, more with that than like physically tired or sore or anything like that. Like,
yeah,
I would be in bed for 10 hours, but I'd sleep for an hour and a half and I'd be completely wide awake, you know, for like 20 minutes. And I'd fall asleep for an hour and a half. Like, my body permanently thought like, oh, this is what you do now. You sleep for an hour and a half on a dirt floor and you get up and do some stuff. So it took me a while to get back to like normal human sleep function.
So do either one of you have like, I'll explain it this way. Sometimes when Paulette comes home from like long backpacking or bike packing trips or where she's been out, she'll stand up in the middle of the bed and like wonder where she's at. And I'm just like, you're at home, go to bed. So do you have any of that kind of weirdness when you get home?
I don't know that I have. I've had like, this time I would be sitting on the couch like trying to read or something, and then it would be 2 hours later.
Yeah.
And I would be like really confused about, I knew where I was, right? But I was like, I don't know what time it is. Like, is it the next morning? You're like, what's going on? Kate, which all I had to do was take care of my dog when I got home, which I think I did an okay job. He's still alive. Kate had to take care of her son like the first day she was back. And I'm like, how is Cliff going to let you be responsible for another human being?
We called for a movie day. It was just, everybody needed a movie day. Yeah. I mean, I had the worst brain fog I've had after a race. And this was, I think it was because we pushed really hard and we pushed without a lot of sleep for, you know, 6.5 days. And then when we finished the race, we were so close to the final cutoff of 7 days that we weren't really able to like rest up after the race either, because we had to get up after only a few hours to go get COVID tested so we could make our flights back home. And then there was like a party we had to go to and, you know, all these things. So we really didn't sleep all that much afterwards. And then, you know, the airport was, I had a couple long layovers that were helpful for snoozing and things. But I mean, it took me a good, I would say 10 days for my brain to come back. And there were times in there I was like, oh my gosh, have I done something permanent? I'm like so fuzzy. I've never been so fuzzy for so long after a race. It was really, it was annoying. I was doing the same thing, Garrison, of like time passing and being like, oh my gosh, what have I just done? Have I just sat on this couch for 2 hours and done nothing? Maybe.
Yeah, I tried to figure out, you know, like you said, it was 6 days and 16 hours or 17 hours, something like that was our official time. Yeah. It was 160 some hours maybe, but like, I think we slept 10 or 11 hours, maybe the whole race.
That's what I got. Yeah. I think 10 or 11 about that.
Which, I mean, there's some teams out there that can do that and, you know, go home and run a half marathon the next weekend maybe, but that, you know, that was the most I'd ever pushed it on the sleep side. And it's not like we were in disagreement on how to manage sleep. It's just, as Mark will say repeatedly, you have all these great plans. Whatever, every great plan lasts, or like the boxer thing, every great plan lasts until you get punched in the face or whatever. You know, yeah. I think the first night's sleep went pretty well and like kind of roughly how we wanted to. The first leg took way longer than we had hoped. But then things just got weird after that. And it'd be like an hour here, a couple hours there, and it never quite got into a rhythm because we were trying to keep it interesting. You know, for the dot watchers, we figured we'd do our best to time it so we could finish inside the two cutoffs in under an hour both times, which we did. So, you know, that was fun.
I mean, was that really the reason your sleep was so screwed up, as you were pushing cutoffs?
Not entirely. Like, I don't remember cutting sleep short because we didn't have time. It was more just how you don't always end up at the right place at the right time. You know, yeah. Like we finished, oh, this is kind of mid race, but the big paddling section, you know, we finished mid afternoon. And that was like the one time I would say the whole race where the team wasn't fully aligned on what to do. We had a little bit of like, you know, we weren't in total agreement. I think it's because we'd done that 60 some odd paddle with the, what felt like a 40 hour portage in the middle of it. And we slept for an hour, you know, in a dirty basement that apparently, according to Kate's race report, was way nastier than I remembered. I thought that place
was amazing. Disgusting. Yeah, but apparently it was the disgusting. Most disgusting place.
But it was dry and it was reasonably flat, you know. But,
it was. And that was, those were its great features.
Right. You know, so that wasn't very good sleep that night. And then we get to that place where you could get a hotel room. And like, and the one argument was, well, we should go while we have daylight and get this huge bike started. The other was, this is our only chance to get sleep in beds. And we were so sleep deprived in the boats coming into it that like we couldn't get like a coherent decision on what to do. So we kind of weren't super efficient, but then we did get a couple hours in beds, which was pretty nice. And then the AR gods tried really hard to make us quit, I feel like. Because all I don't know what happened. Kate's main bike light crapped out, and then her headlamp started acting weird. And then we're convinced that a lupine headlight virus exists because her headlamp started making other batteries stop working right. Jason had like a low speed crash on his mountain bike and tore up his hip. And we hadn't even left town yet. Like, we're in the town that starts this big bike leg and all this stuff's happening. Like, it was so, it's like those things seem to happen. And then when we find a good place to sleep is how it always works. It wasn't quite the right time. And then when we really wanted to sleep, we couldn't find a good place. And so we just kept kind of doing these survival, not quite survival naps of 20 minutes, but like an hour or two, and then kept pushing.
Yeah. It's funny because I think like we could have, it would have been nice had we been able to find one other place to maybe get a longer sleep in. But I also think on the upside, we were trying really hard not to get into that trap of being like, okay, we should find a place to sleep, and then moving slowly for hours, like stopping everywhere, trying to assess how, you know, could we sleep here? Could we sleep here? So, you know, we definitely ran on the side of maybe a little bit less sleep. But, you know, I don't think we really had any like sleep related catastrophes, you know, in terms of nap errors or other, like Garrison was saying, that one going into that one TA where the hotel was, I think our sleep deprivation did make us a little bit kind of out of sync and sort of not communicating super effectively. But beyond that, I think we managed it pretty well. So that was cool to see, like, okay, you know, if this is what it takes, then, you know, we can race this way if we have to.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, how hard was the race? Did you think it was going to be that hard? You know, expectation wise.
Good question.
We knew the distances were big.
Yeah.
Right. So like going into it, that's always in the back of your mind. Like, oh wow, like these are some of the longest legs I've ever personally done in a race. So that should be interesting. We didn't know, we had a suspicion it wasn't going to be like 75 mile cross country trek, because that's a lot of time. The math just doesn't work for that. And we were doing gear prep in the stadium. Some British guy came over, it was racing with the Spanish team, and we were having the same conversation with him. And he said, oh, don't worry, like almost all the trekking will be on tracks and trails and roads and stuff like that. We're like, really? He's like, yeah, that's how racing in Spain is done. And so that kind of, you wanted to feel hopeful, right? Like, okay, if that's the case, then the times should be pretty manageable, but you don't want to be too hopeful. So when you get out there and you get 20 miles cross country through nasty bush that you're like totally soul crushed by it. It was managing the distances and the times, because we had two or three legs that were over 24 hours. I think Jason even said like he'd never done a race with that many legs that were that long. Mm-hmm. And so it was definitely a matter of just like, okay, I'm going to think about this leg and ignore everything after that. There's just still a lot out. It felt to me anyways, at times felt like a lot left.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was funny because it was definitely a hard race, but it was hard in a different way than other hard races can be, in terms of like, yeah, there weren't a lot of, you know, technical sections, and there wasn't a lot of like, okay, we're going to be moving 1 kilometer an hour through like, yeah, really thick or slow moving terrain. And mentally that was nice, because it was like, okay, we are moving and moving feels good. But then on the other hand, you know, yeah, the distances were so long. And I think what I didn't really expect was as much pavement as there was. And that just hurt. Like by the end of the race, the last, you know, 30K foot section was like 20K almost probably on maybe 15, at least half on road. And that just hurt so much. So it was like managing the physical pain from that was very hard. And then, yeah, just the sheer distances, like maybe we were moving well, but we knew we had to go for so long. So we really settled into, like Garrison said, you know, one stage at a time, almost like in my mind, I was just thinking like, okay, I'm trekking today and I'll trek all day today and most of the day tomorrow, and just trying to kind of get my mind into that sort of mode.
Yeah.
So I suppose Mackenzie probably wanted to, had to do all your navigation because he's that guy, but what was the nav like?
We actually did a really good job on team nav. It took a day to get into the groove, but like, you know, everybody's got their highs and lows, right? And we had two sets of maps, which was 104 maps or something like that, like a ridiculous amount of weight to carry on that first section. We kind of were wondering if it was such a good idea, and then we kept forgetting to stash some of the maps. We carried those damn things for longer than we should have, but anyways, we did a good job of we always had one person with their stuff together, usually two. And there was lots of times where it was just like, you'd hit the wall and I'd turn to Mark. I'd have the maps. I'd turn to Mark and be like, how are you feeling? He's like, I'm all right. I'm like, here, like, I can't remember my name right now. I don't need these in my hands. I'm going to get us in trouble. And the nav wasn't, you weren't going to make any moves or do anything brilliant with the nav that was going to move you up in the race. All you were going to do is kind of screw yourself up. So you just had to be clean. You had to be efficient. For us, the biggest challenge is getting out of the villages. Started on the first night, we go into the village and we walk out of the village and you'd think that you're on the right track, but like the main road may be what looked like somebody's driveway or between two old buildings. And the big wide track is actually junk that's not on the map. And so I'd say it took us like 2.5 days to like get our act together and learn how to navigate out of these tiny Spanish villages. But other than that, it was the teamwork, handing off the maps and just not making mistakes, which really, other than leaving a couple of villages in the wrong direction for a few hundred meters and going, that's not right, and turning around and going back, we didn't have anything that was really bad. And a couple spots that could have been ugly, like night nav, second to last night, Mark was on the maps at that point and it got kind of screwy and he was on it. He was focused and he got us through it. So yeah, it wasn't like that race where you strategize, make this really aggressive nav decision to try and make up space. It was like, let's just not take any extra steps, especially not extra steps on pavement.
Interesting. So like when I was talking with Quest, they said that the bike nav was hard because it was so fast. And you just had to like concentrate so much because there's so many little roads and trails and you're moving fast. You guys kind of have that too?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, it's so interesting whenever you race in a place that's been, you know, well inhabited by lots and lots of people for well over 1,000 years, it's like it reflects that. And so there were just tons of roads and tons of trails and everything was like, well, you know, around my house, it's like, you know, you go off on a trail and it could just end somewhere. And you would never know until you get there. But everything was just, super well tracked. So I think the biggest trick for I was only navigating on paddle, so I didn't have to deal with it on foot or bike. But watching these guys try to figure out the bike routes was just, you know, it was impressive because they had to be so on it. And I think that's where the sleep piece could have been a problem. And I certainly know there were some teams around us that struggled with having maybe a single navigator and then that person getting just wiped out by, you know, the race itself and then having to navigate for that long and stay focused. So a real strength, I think, was every single one of us, all four of us, navigated at various points. So that was kind of fun for each of us to stay engaged, but also to give other people a break, let people turn their brains off. So that worked really well for us.
Yeah, like most races too, even in shorter races, it takes you a while to figure out how much can I rely on this map? How much can I trust?
Yeah.
And after on the first big foot section, you know, 10 or 12 hours, like, okay, this is actually pretty spot on. We had one weird thing with a trail that wasn't on the map that didn't work in our favor. It didn't hurt us too bad. Took a little detour, but we weren't the only ones. But, you know, it was pretty, like Kate was saying, everything's so well traveled for so long. If it's on the map, it's there. Right.
Yeah.
So it's just, in some cases, a bunch of other stuff too. So you have to be careful with that. But.
So it, this, I mean, this is so different than, you know, maybe what a person would think of an expedition race where you're literally out in the middle of nowhere. And like you said, you can bushwhack everywhere and you have lots of choices for routes and stuff. Did you enjoy the race from that perspective, from the navigation, or would you like to have had some, oh, maybe we'd go over that mountain would be better.
I mean, my background in racing, we always was on teams where we weren't the physically strongest team. And so we always needed races with some really challenging nav to get ahead of some teams. And I think with our team that we had, because like Kate said, we were all navigators, like a race with some sections like that, either whether it's bike nav or foot nav, where it was like really tricky, you had a lot of options and you really had to be on it. I think that would have worked in our favor, as long as it wasn't still sections of the same length. Because, you know,
yeah.
I physically and like pain wise, you know, I was kind of at my limit a couple times. So I don't know if I wanted a 75 mile trek with 30 miles of cross country travel. But that's my opinion. I think we would have probably, it would have worked well for us had there been some sections like that. But we got to see a lot of Spain when the sun was up. Anyways.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's kind of like, it's all the destination sort of determines that, though, you know, like, I don't think there is much just like untravel or like little traveled terrain in, I mean, much of Western Europe, right? So
yeah,
it's hard to find that kind of stretch of wilderness feeling. So I felt like for what they had, it was a pretty interesting course. But yeah, I agree with Garrison. Like, had there been a little more nav choice even, or kind of tricky nav choice, that probably would have suited us well.
Yeah, makes sense for sure. How many times did you buy food on the course?
Jeez.
A few. I mean, we had to keep it civilized, you know,
yeah.
Cafe con leche in the morning. we had this great, one of my favorite memories is after we made the first cutoff, we rolled into what was, I believe, our second cafe of the race. So we, right in town, right next to the TA, once we got out of there, we stopped at a cafe, and Jason rolled in there and ordered 8 cafe con leches. And the woman was like, 8 of them, you know, like, and we didn't speak much Spanish. Yeah, we didn't speak much Spanish. She didn't speak any English. And he was in there negotiating for a while, trying to really convince her, like, yes, we needed 8 of them. So we actually shifted our cafe con leche strategy after that. So what we would do is order 4. And then once they were delivered, we'd immediately order 4 more, because that seemed to be less kind of alarming to people. But yeah, I mean, we had coffee every day with maybe a croissant or a little sandwich. But I mean, I think we probably stopped, what, maybe like 5 times?
Probably. But because, again, coming back to the legs being so long, you know, 75-mile trek, you had a 175-mile bike. We didn't stop at any cafes other than the beginning of the paddle, but they're big things.
Yeah.
So like knowing there was a big village in the map and that we were going to be there in daylight was good, right?
That was motivating.
You have something to break it up. Jason's wife was there, and so she was kind of bouncing around. So we kind of get to see her and say hi. And like, you know, we'd get there, we'd have our coffee and our sandwich, and then we'd get back at it. So we didn't, I think, ever really get too sucked in, like, gear bombing and spreading out for 2 or 3 hours and losing momentum. You know, it was just enough to get the spirits back, get some caffeine, and keep going.
Yeah, I agree. Something? What was kind of cool was, like, there were very, I thought, you know, on the maps, you'd see all these little towns. So I, in my mind, I was like, oh, Cafe Conleche everywhere. But no, it was like these tiny little towns that had, you know, like a few houses or sometimes maybe even 100 people living there, but definitely no cafe. So it was only when you got to the big one. So that was actually a nice kind of waypoint for us.
Did you guys have to make a conscious decision, like when you stopped, to like not chill out and spend, like you said, spend 2 hours dinking around?
Yeah, I mean, we just...
I mean, I think that was... Go ahead.
I would say, yeah, we talked about that. Like, it was interesting because we were all completely in agreement we've got to stop. And we were all in completely in agreement that we're not going to stop for super long.
Yeah.
And so, like, we'd be there for 10, 20 minutes and somebody would be like, all right, let's do it. Let's get out of here. And there wasn't, like, anybody saying, oh, no, I just need to take my shoes off and rest. Or it was just as soon as somebody said we got to go, we all went, yep, okay, let's go. And we got our stuff together and hit the road.
But you guys have never all raced together, right? As a team, the four of you. You've probably been at 1,000 races together. So did it take a little bit of time to gel as a team? Or I'm guessing not, because you guys are racers and you know what you're doing.
Well,
that was one. Yeah, we've raced together. We did Eco Challenge, so that was helpful. And I think but then on the other hand, well, and we were, I was the least experienced person on the team. Garrison next, and then, you know, Jason and Mark have done many races. One cool thing I thought was, because we got there with some time to spare before the race, you know, we were doing all our pre-race stuff together. We were going out to dinner and kind of just like bonding generally as a team. So that felt really helpful. And then, you know, for me, my perspective going in was like, all right, this is my opportunity to race with some people who are much more experienced than me. So I want to be just watching and trying to kind of follow the lead there a little bit. So that was, you know, and I think everybody was motivated, of course, to get along and figure it out. And we did all, you know each other at least to some degree beforehand. So that helped. But I don't know about you, Garrison. I didn't think it took us too long to really get into sync together.
No, I mean, you've got teams that don't even get really functional in the course of the full race. And I think we were functional out of the gate, meaning we could work well together. There wasn't any tension. There wasn't any like major issues or even minor issues. And by the end, we were actually learning each other's like idiosyncrasies enough that we were getting more and more efficient and working as well together as a team as some teams might after maybe 4 or 5 races together. So I think it was great from that perspective, because like Kate mentioned, she and I didn't have a ton of expedition experience, but we've raced enough, right? And so I think that everybody's experienced enough that, and we knew each other well enough from seeing each other out there over the last 10, 15, 20 years, things clicked relatively quickly.
Yeah, I would. That's kind of what I was expecting. Hey, do you guys, I mean, beforehand, do you were you hanging out with other teams, or did you kind of try to kind of stay by yourself and get your own stuff going? Or could you socialize a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit. We stayed on our own schedule, right? So we didn't like make dinner plans with other teams, because then all of a sudden their timing is off from your timing, and then you're doing things out of whack from how you want to do it. But, you know, we were, you know, chatting with people in the lobby and down at the arena and stuff like that. The big socializing with other teams happened afterwards, where Kate, I will say, is responsible for finding a restaurant that would take 16 people, because most of the Americans that were there ate together after the race. It was an Octopus restaurant. But it's 16 people. And I gotta say, the Octopus is really good. I mean, if I hadn't have been like 180 hours or whatever, 170 hours at that point on no sleep, I may not have been as eager to go, but it's like, whatever, this works.
Yeah, you were really kind of looking for McDonald's.
You could have put anything in front of me. I bought a gallon of dark chocolate not ice cream. What's the gelato?
Gelato. Yeah.
I was convinced I could eat after the race, and it almost killed me.
They had fries and potatoes and stuff, so that went down pretty well.
So I'd have been okay.
Yeah, right, Randy. You would have been. You would have found something.
Chicken and potatoes.
Yeah, like when I was in Portugal, I was just a big fan of finding the bakery, because you can find a bakery anywhere. It's like you just point to two or three things and you know they'd be good. So,
exactly. Well,
it's like you don't want to get too distracted by like seeing the sights before the race starts. Mm-hmm. Like you have to stay somewhat focused, but you're not going to travel to some place you've never been before and just eat in the hotel lobby and stay in your room and try and focus on the race. Like we weren't. Anyway. So I think we did a good balance of going out and trying and failing to order the right amount of food at tapas restaurants for the 3 days before the race and had a good time, like Kate said, getting to know each other and stuff like that. So it was fun.
Yeah. So did you, like food and stuff, did you take most everything that you were going to eat, or did you, know, were there go to the grocery or find stuff, or how'd that work for you?
Luckily, there was a huge grocery right near us. So right by the hotel, between the hotel and the arena where everyone's gear was. So I brought very little. And it's hard. I mean, even though the gear requirements weren't too crazy for this race, but even still, you fill up your weight from the allotted amounts from the airport pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So I usually end up buying a lot of my food when I get there, which for me, I don't have a particularly sensitive stomach. I know what works well for me. I know that when I travel to Europe, they've got a great cookie selection, for example. So I was pretty excited to, go to the grocery store and stock up on some things that were sort of on the border of being familiar, like variations on my American theme. So it's a good way too, I think, to just not get sick of race food. If I eat something too much, I get so sick of it. So I bought a ton of food. I probably bought like 35,000 calories of food there.
I only brought like the engineered race food that I know I like that I'm not going to find there, like salted watermelon Clif Blocks. I can always eat those. It always tastes good to me. So, which is unfortunate that I brought those because they're freaking heavy as heck. So that was like really into my allotment, but same thing, and it's funny because you walk up and down the aisles trying to figure out what you're going to get. And you only thing you know is that the one thing you only get three of is going to be a thing that wish you'd gotten 14 of. And for me, it was these Boston cream pie, little pastry rectangle things that were like 450 calories. And I could eat one of those in about 90 seconds. And I got six, and I looked forward to those so much when I got to them. I wish I had more of them, but.
Yeah. Do you find you're walking up and down the aisle and there's things like they sort of look like Oreos, but not exactly, or they're the chips are not quite right, but that's probably what they are.
Pretty much.
I really had one thing that one of us, I forget if it was me, it was definitely me or you, Kate. We got something. It was like a trail mix looking thing. And it was like, oh, this should be good. And it took like two bites of it. And I'm like, yeah, nope, that's not going to work. I don't know what that is. That is not good. But everything else, I'm with Kate.
I think it wasn't that that curry flavored one.
Maybe. Yeah. Whatever it was nasty. I didn't like that. But the cookies over there were solid. Like Kate dropped a whole bag of cookies out of their kayak. And I snaked them out of the water to give back to her. Then I ate them all instead and told her at the end of the paddle. So
I was sick of the cookies. So it worked out all right.
All right. So you guys were not at the sharp end of the race. By the time you were going through places, did like the locals know what was going on? Did they know who you were, or they just ignore you?
In some places, yes. And in one place in particular, definitely. And it was this second to last night. So it was the 40-mile trek, the windmill trek, is how I always think of that one, windmill farmland. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those times where where did that come from? Kate had like sudden flare up of some, probably like tendonitis in her knee. It was like pretty bad. and it's like 10 o'clock at night. And so it would have been a great time to sleep. We found this nice pile of dry hay, but everybody in the little town was still awake and like moving around and stuff. And we're like, well, this isn't really going to work. We're like in somebody's backyard and then we're going to fall asleep and they're going to come kick us out, or that's not really cool. So we kept moving, I don't know, a couple hours, and we found a place with not as good of hay, but it was still under a shelter, laid down. And I was laying closest to the road out maybe 15 minutes. And I hear a car, and it wakes me up. And they, I'm just like shrinking down as small as I can, thinking maybe if they don't see us that this won't get weird. And the car stops. And I'm like, oh crap. And so I jump up, and luckily one of the few things I know in Spanish is lo siento, you know, I'm sorry. And so I'm like, lo siento, you know, we're gonna move. We just had to rest. Long story short, the guy owned the farm we were sleeping on and had been following the race online, saw our dot stop on his farm. So he came out to see if we wanted to come inside and sleep, and he was going to offer us showers and beds and make us breakfast in the morning. And we're like, well, no, we got to, you know, a couple hours, then we got to keep moving. But yeah, we ended up chatting with him for a little bit and stayed in an old, old building, which I guess used to be where they would like bake bread and store food and stuff like that. And had a beer with him, made a fire in the fireplace, and knocked out for a couple hours.
Nice.
Yeah, it was pretty
That's a good memory.
Yeah, it was very cool. Those are the types of things. Yeah, it's like type of thing that even if it throws you off your like schedule, you do it anyways, right? Because this is like kind of experience you don't have unless you're doing one of these events.
Yeah. Very cool. So what's the feeling when you cross the finish line? Relief, joy, happy, sad?
I mean, it's funny. I remember we were walking in towards the finish line and I was trying to convey my appreciation to my awesome teammates. And I kept trying to say like, I had a great time, but I couldn't quite like say the words because I was in such a cute pain. And I was like, I am sure that later I will remember that I had a great time with you guys. It was, for me, it was 100% relief. And a little bit of like, I think my excitement was more when like earlier when we made that second cutoff after that the long bike leg. And I was like, oh my gosh, because our goal for the race was to finish full course. And we knew that that was actually quite a stretch goal looking at the course schematic. So once we, and I've never finished a full course ARWS race. So I was like that, going in, that was my kind of personal, like, oh, it'd be so cool if we could do this. And once we met that second cutoff, that was when I was like super excited, especially once we then did the second to last trek. Once we rolled into that short little paddle before the final trek, I thought, okay, we're going to finish this race. That's, and I was like finding myself getting really emotional and I don't know, crying, but happy tears this time. Mm-hmm. And then once we actually crossed the finish line, I was just like, get me off my feet. I'm so done. I can't, you know, so it was really relief for me that I think the excitement had happened, you know, earlier once I realized we were going to do it barring some disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, you know, when we crossed the finish line, it was like 5:30 in the morning or something like that. Yeah. There was like nobody there.
Nobody. And it was cold.
41st team to cross the finish line. I think 43 or 44 total finished the whole race. And like it was us, it was Kelly was there, Jason's wife, and a couple people from the race staff. But it was just us. But it was like somehow that felt kind of right and appropriate, because you always talk in adventure racing how you go out and you do the best your team can against the course. And if you beat everybody or you beat people, that's secondary. But like, you got to focus on what you can do. And that almost always breaks down to some extent when you're at the pointy end. Because if you're in first or second and you see a team in front or behind you, you can't not have that affect you in some way. Really good teams know how to minimize it. But no matter what, it's in your head. But we just knew like it was just us versus the course the whole race. And we were around teams and stuff. But it really was just us and the piece of work that we were taking on. And I'm with Kate, like, it was a rush for me. It was a rush at the top of that last ridge line, thinking, holy crap, we're going to make the cutoff. Then we made a wrong turn. We're like, holy crap, we're going to miss the cutoff. And then we recovered. And then we're like, holy crap, we made the cutoff. And so that was like the big emotional, like, yeah, we're actually yeah, we're going to do this. But yeah, the finish line, it was like just us and Kelly, but that was cool. I was good with it. And yeah, my feet hurt so bad. I loved you guys, but I just wanted to go lay down because I won't stand up anymore.
they poured us some beers and we sat around this little sitting area for like, I don't know, 10 minutes maybe, until we're all like, we're so cold and so tired, we need to leave. So we were much happier after we slept.
Which I think I asked somebody this, like if Kelly hadn't have been there,
I think cabs.
Some poor Uber driver would have to drive our four stank asses back to the...
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. Okay.
Instead, poor Kelly had to do it.
Yeah, right.
We were disgusting.
Yeah. So the question is, did you take a shower before you fell asleep, or did you just fall asleep and not worry about it?
I showered. I didn't
shower.
Okay.
I showered when we slept at that hotel in the middle of the race, because I mean, first of all, it's nice to shower, I suppose, if you can, but I also just, you know, you look at the bed and it's so clean and white, and I'm like, I cannot get my body into that clean bed like this.
I got the crusty dirt off enough to not leave a human print of dirt in the bed.
Very cool. So from the Department of Obvious Questions, did you have a good time?
Yeah, it was a cool experience. And like I said, lots of it hurt, right? Like the first leg, I'm like, my feet are messed up. This is like, I'm not accustomed to this. But yeah, when you have a team that clicks as well as ours did and accomplishes the goals the way that we did, I think the official scale is type 1 fun and type 2 fun. There may be like a type 3, and I sometimes call it type 4, that I'm never going to look back and say the back end of that 75-mile trek felt good or was quote-unquote fun. But I'm really, really glad we did it. And so when I look at the whole thing, it was definitely fun.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. In fact, I think it would be safe to say I was as miserable as I've ever been in my life on actually that 75-mile trek. I had some real mental lows. Garrison knows.
She may or may not have told us to leave her dead body in a ditch and finish the race without her.
I did. I was like, you guys would be so much better off if I wasn't here. But the cool thing, I mean, and this is something I've just learned about myself, like the first 24 to 36 hours of a long race is not my favorite. Like, it's just, I'm still settling in and I'm feeling that kind of like, oh my gosh, there's so much left to go. And I'm only 24 hours in. And I have a lot of self-doubt. But for me, like, part of what I love is then now, right? Like, it's 6 weeks later and I can look back and say that I finished it, and I can remember those lows, and I can remember the hilarious times we had too. I mean, we had a lot of just like, you know, fun conversation and all the silly things that just happen when you're sleep deprived in a foreign country where you don't speak the language. And so we had a great time. And I feel like, you know, you have to have those lows in order to even just like the highs feel so much higher when you think about that comparison. So, I mean, the range of feelings that's, I mean, I do adventure racing for a lot of reasons, but I will say that that kind of like, you know, that you can go from just total suffering to, you know, elation and hilarity and, you know, all the things in between within even just a couple hours is pretty cool. So, my memory likes to drop the worst memories pretty quickly. So I've mostly got the good ones left, and we had a great time.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, perfect. All right, so this is where we're done. So I'm going to say thank you. Can't wait to see you guys later this year. Then I'm going to push the stop record button, and then I'm going to hit the end button. Is that good?
Sounds good.
Right. Good plan, Randy.
Thank you, guys. All right.
Thanks, see you later. Randy. Always good to chat with you.
All right.
See you, Randy.
Bye. Bye.
Girl, I love someone else. I had to hide the way I felt. Over my shoulder, brownstone stands. glad to lend a helping hand. To bring me down, makes my mind go round and round. At last I thought I'm in control. Mr. Brasco wants your soul. Yeah, and I found out this little trick of using drugs to make you sick. Now I try to fight this beat, make myself a strong machine. Strong machine. Strong machine. Strong machine. God's will and mine wins in the end. I never need Brownstone's help again. So leave me now and ease my mind. I don't feel life is so unkind. Yeah, and I found out this little trick of saving drugs to make you sick. Now I try to fight this beat, make myself a strong machine.